Right, we're continuing now with our Bible study in the book of Revelation. And last week we spent much of our time, I believe, in Revelation chapter 12. So you may as well open your Bible at that point, but equally get your famous $50 note and just park it there, because we'll be moving to a few of the scriptures and then back again to Revelation 13, I would hope at least. And in Revelation 12, we spent some time looking at the what we have called the place of safety. If you look at Revelation chapter 12, verse 14, we can see here a reference to the woman, whom we take to be the people of God, the church of God. A woman usually represents a church, sometimes a nation, but in this context we take this to be the church, was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly, and the Greek there actually does mean fly as with wings, into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time, that's 3.5 times, from the presence of Satan the serpent. And so we said last week, well, is there indeed a place of refuge? Is there a place of safety? Because it certainly reads that way, does it not? And we looked at several scriptures and other parts of the Bible and the Psalms and so on, which do refer to a place of refuge, God's secret place, his pavilion in the time of trouble. And then we said verse 17, and the dragon was enraged with the woman who had now managed to escape him, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Surprise, surprise. When the woman flies to this place where she's nourished for time, times and half a time, we take that to be about 3.5 years, about 42 months, about 1260 days, the times appear in various parts of the scriptures. But when Satan discovers that the woman has managed to get out of his control, he is further enraged, what he was to start with actually, but he's even more enraged now, and he turns around and makes war. Well, to make war is obviously to persecute, to fight against, and I think we'll see later, to kill those of her offspring who have been, quotes, left behind. And notice that those who are left behind keep the commandments and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Early in the book of Revelation, we find out that the book of Revelation is an important part of the testimony of Jesus Christ. So these may be people with a prophetic understanding, or at least prophetic knowledge, who are commandment keepers, and they are left behind. Now, the King James Version talks about makes war with the remnant, which has this sort of implication, at least probably to most of us, that it's the smaller number who are left behind, and perhaps the majority who go to this place, wherever it might be. And I said last week that, well, I certainly cannot say for sure, but I get a bit of a feeling, looking at two or three scriptures, that maybe it's the other way around, and maybe it's the minority who fly off, and the majority who are left behind. And somebody said afterwards, well, which scriptures did I have in mind? So I'll get to those in a moment or two. But we said last week, as we concluded, that where might the place of safety be? And I suppose the answer is, if only we knew. Because none of us knows where the place of safety is, although, you know, we have, I'm sure, between us a few ideas. Certainly the most long-lived idea among the Church of God in recent decades has been the place of Petra, or sometimes I believe pronounced Petra, particularly on the west side of the Atlantic. But over here, in God's own country, we normally call it Petra. And Petra is a place that's been bouncing around the Church of God for at least 50 or more years. And some say, well, Herbert Armstrong, it was just a wild, crazy idea. Where did it come from? It's completely ludicrous, and so on and so forth. Well, we'll have a look at a few scriptures, just two or three, because there are some indications that Petra looks like it could be the place, but they are slightly obscure scriptural references. And Mr. Armstrong himself, as we'll read in a moment, didn't ever say dogmatically, categorically, it would be Petra. And Mr. Armstrong actually went to visit Petra for the very first time way back in 1956. He went there with his wife, Loma, and with his elder son, Richard. So Dick, Loma, and Mr. Herbert Armstrong went for a visit to Jordan and went down to Petra. Petra is about 100 miles south of Amman, which is the capital of Jordan. And Mr. Armstrong wrote about it in his co-worker letter, dated 8th of May 1956. This, I think, is probably the earliest reference of Mr. Armstrong's writings to it. So he's really writing about his trip, not writing about prophecy or anything like that. And he says, we later took a three-day tour down to Petra, the mysterious, awe-inspiring ancient city built in a rock called the Rose Red City, half as old as time, which is probably said in some of the brochures. He talks about driving down in a Ford motor car, but then he says, and this I have to chuckle slightly in my imagination, he says, the last 4 miles going in and coming out were ridden on horseback. I just find it mildly amusing thinking of Mr. Armstrong on the back of a horse, but I guess he was younger and probably a bit slimmer in those days. So anyway, they all went off on horseback for the last 4 miles into Petra and back out again. He carries on. Some details were also written in Mrs. Armstrong's diary, published in the November 1956 Plain Truth. So Mrs. Armstrong wasn't overly impressed. She said that because of the cold, she went to bed early in one of the caves. Quote, with hunger and cold, I began to see that Petra was no bed of roses, but a place to really rough it. So Mr. Armstrong and the wife and elder son paid a visit there in the mid-1950s. A dramatic place, awe-inspiring place, but certainly not terribly pleasant to visit. Then in 1978, Mr. Armstrong was being challenged by a few people about his views on Petra and other doctrines, and he's putting up a bit of a defense to all the allegations made against him, and he says, now, where is the place? Talking of the place of safety. And that's been a great contention, he says, quote, I used to preach the possibility that it would be at Petra. Well, I don't know that it will be at Petra, and I never said I knew it would be. See, Mr. Armstrong was being accused of having categorically said Petra, and others were saying, well, it's certainly not there, and therefore Herbert Armstrong's wrong in this as well as in other areas. Mr. Armstrong was saying, well, hang on a second, I've said it could be, I've said it's possible, but I've never said I knew it definitely would be. He carries on. Others say, well, that's something we can get back at Herbert Armstrong. Let's just say that he was wrong about that. And some very high in the church were saying that it's a lot of rubbish and hodgepodge. I say to you now, I don't know whether it's Petra. I don't know where it is or where it will be, but I know God knows. But I do know this much. There are many indications that it is Petra. And if it isn't Petra, then the Bible gives us absolutely no indication of where it will be. So I'll read that part again because it's, I think, the final word from Mr. Armstrong. I do know this much. There are many indications that it is Petra. And if it isn't Petra, then the Bible gives us absolutely no indication of where it will be. Now I'll stand my ground with that. And any of you who want to can come and face me with it. In any case, I've been to Petra, and it's not a very pleasant place to be. And I think that probably is fair comment. It's not a terribly pleasant place to be. So Mr. Armstrong was fairly, I think, clear on that. He thought there are many indications, but they are indications only. They are far from definite. They are more so clues and hints, and maybe it is. And then again, maybe it isn't. And I said Petra is about 100 miles south of Amman, which is the capital. Petra is also these days, and this is somewhat different from Mr. Armstrong's time, it is actually the number one tourist attraction in Jordan. So it's no longer a sort of a super secret place that only those in the know have heard about. Nowadays, it's like there's coach loads of people every day heading down to Petra. It is the number one, most famous, most visited tourist attraction in the country of Jordan. They have over 10,000 people a month trolling in and out, in and out, in and out, day by day by day, and probably throwing their Coca-Cola cans inside and so on. So it's no longer, you know, a highly confidential, top secret location. It's one of the best known in the whole world. It's actually been nominated as one of the world's, you know, top 7 or 8 places to visit. It's full of caverns, caves. It's got a temple, amphitheater. It is big enough, apparently, to host about 250,000 people. So it's quite a sizable city, long deserted. And Mr. Herman Hay, that many of you will know from the past, has said, quotes, that Petra is, quotes, mentioned in the Bible more than any other city other than Jerusalem, Samaria, and Babylon. Well, I didn't know that until I came across that reference, but he says that of all the cities that you find from Genesis to Revelation, after Jerusalem, Samaria, and Babylon, the next most mentioned city is Petra. But not by that name. Petra has a number of names in the scripture, like Paran, Kadesh, Kadesh Barnea, Mount Seir, and so on. But if you tot them all up, says Mr. Hay, Petra is very, very frequently mentioned. So, is the place of safety Petra? Well, we don't know, but let's look at just three places that sort of give a vague hint. Isaiah chapter 33. Isaiah chapter 33, and we'll start reading in verse 10 when we get there. Isaiah 33 verse 10. Now I will rise, it says Jehovah God, now I will be exalted, now I will lift myself up. Talking of a time yet future when God's about to step in his might and power and take control. You shall conceive chaff, you shall bring forth stubble, your breath as fire shall devour you, and the people shall be like the burnings of lime, like thorns cut up, they shall be burned in the fire. And I've got an inspired marginal note saying nuclear holocaust. So we're talking here of a time when God steps in and when there's going to be nuclear holocaust, asteroids, meteors, massive burning, and people are going to be burned up just like thorns being burnt in a bonfire. Verse 13, hear, you who are afar off, what I have done, and you who are near, acknowledge my might, says, you know, the eternal God. Verse 14, the sinners in Zion are afraid, which is intriguing because most of the time, Zion in prophecy means the church. And in fact, throughout the book of Isaiah in particular, the term Zion is used again and again and again, talking of the church of God and the people of God. So there's a reference here to the sinners in the church, let's say, who are suddenly afraid. Because obviously one imagines that they've realized that, oops, I've left it too late. I've not been paying attention. I have been taking it too easy. I have been distracted. And now the sinners in the church are afraid. Fearfulness has seized the hypocrites. I take that to be the hypocrites in Zion, the hypocrites in the church. So you don't want to be found as a sinner or a hypocrite in Zion. Otherwise, when this time comes and the eternal stands up, and the fire and burnings begin, you might be afraid and filled with fearfulness. And they say, who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? Who can survive this fire, this holocaust? Verse 15, this is the answer. This is the one who can survive. he who walks righteously and speaks uprightly, he who despises the gain of oppressions, who gestures with his hands refusing bribes, who stops his ears from hearing of bloodshed, shuts his eyes from seeing evil. Here's a person in Zion, in the church, who is actually living the right way, who is careful of what they say and think and what they do. He is an upright person when the plumb line, if you like, is hung against them. When they are measured, they come through successfully. Okay, and this person, male or female, will be able to dwell with and survive these everlasting burnings and these fires. Verse 16, he, talking of this person, will dwell on high. His place of defense will be the fortress of rocks. Rocks in Hebrew is Sela. The Greek is Petra. Petra means rock. Sela means rock. And so you could easily translate this, if you wanted to, as his place of defense will be the fortress of Petra. Indeed, that's what I've scribbled in one of my inspired marginal notes. So this is indicative. It's certainly far from proof. I'm not saying it is. Mr. Armstrong wouldn't either. It's just interesting. Here at the end time, prophetically, hypocrites and sinners in the church, fire burning, everlasting fire. Those who are upright will survive, and their place of defense, it suggests, will be the fortress of Petra. Another translation would say the stronghold of rocks, or the stronghold of Petra. Then carrying on, bread will be given him, his water will be sure. So even in this, let's say, fortress of Petra, he'll be provided with nourishment, bread, food, water, I guess, adequate for their needs. And verse 17, your eyes will see the king, capital K, in his beauty. They will see the land that is very far off. And apparently, I'm told, that you can see the land of Canaan and Palestine, land of Israel, from high up in part of the mountains around Petra. But verse 17, your eyes will see the king. If I was talking of Jesus Christ's return, well, it all seems to be very much a description of events taking place right at the very end, when Jesus comes back in his eyes and we see him with our eyes. But interesting that it does refer to there as the fortress of Sela, the fortress of Petra, and it's a place of defense. And also they will be provided with bread and water. And I think that doesn't mean just like in a prison, you know, nothing but bread and water, but it's just talking about, you know, be nourished, looked after, well tended to. Isaiah chapter 42, a bit obscure, as all these tend to be, but we're just looking for really hints and clues. It's not going to say, basically, is it? Sort of flashing letter somewhere, oh, by the way, everybody, I'm going to take my people to a place of safety in Petra, Jordan, and the zip code is as follows. It's not going to be quite as blunt as that. Here a little, there a little, and so on. So Isaiah 42, and again, looking at the sort of the hints and clues here, starting in verse 10. Sing to the Eternal a new song, and his praise from the ends of the earth, you who go down to the sea, and all that is in it, you coastlands, and you inhabitants of them. Let the wilderness, remember the woman flies into the wilderness, let the wilderness and its cities lift up their voice, the villages that Kedar inhabits, let the inhabitants of Sela sing, let them shout from the top of the mountains. Now, Kedar or Kedar, Mr. Hay said, refers to the Bedouins, the Bedouin Arabs. So we're talking here of a wilderness area which is populated by, amongst others, Bedouin Arabs. But notice also it says, let the inhabitants, or let the occupants of Sela sing. Or let's put Petra in, because Petra is the Greek for Sela. Let the inhabitants of Petra sing. Let them shout from the top of the mountains. So here's occupants, people who inhabit Petra, singing and shouting from the top of the mountains, and Petra's in a mountain range. But hang on a second, today there aren't occupants in Petra. Petra is deserted. You take your air-conditioned bus down there, and you maybe, you know, get on your camel or whatever donkey for the last few miles if you go in through the little narrow entrance, and then you look around, and then at the end of the day you just disappear back to a nice comfortable hotel room. And apart from a few enthusiasts sort of camping out there, there aren't occupants. So this scripture, in a sense, prophetically couldn't apply today because there aren't any inhabitants of Petra or Selah to sing. Verse 12, let them give glory to the Eternal and declare his praise in the coastlands. The Eternal shall go forth like a mighty man. He shall stir up his zeal like a man of war. He shall cry out, yes, shout aloud. He shall prevail against his enemies. So the description is of a time when the Almighty God is at war. He's stirring himself up like a man of war. He's shouting and he's prevailing against his enemies. Well, that certainly fits the end of the age, the day of the Lord and his intervention. And it suggests here, I'll admit it's a suggestion, that at that time when God goes forth to fight as a man of war, there will be some inhabiting Petra. And those who inhabit Petra will sing for glory and shout from the mountains as all this takes place. So it's like, well, I guess that could be the church. That could be the believers who've been in hiding there for, you know, 3.5 years. And now as it comes to an end, they're shouting for joy and praising God as he battles and puts down the governments of mankind. So that's why Mr. Armstrong thought, well, there's at least two scriptures there that sort of suggest that Selah or Petra will be occupied by the righteous in Zion and so on. Another one, which is probably even more obscure in a sense, is in Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11. There's a couple of other scriptures, but they're even more awkward and even less clear, so I'll skip over those ones. But it's just Mr. Armstrong, as you heard earlier, never said categorically it will be. Mr. Ted Armstrong categorically said it wouldn't be. Mr. Ted Armstrong went to visit Petra in 1966, I think it was, on his broadcasts from various places around the globe, on the spot broadcast or something. And he went to Petra anyway, and he came back and said, definitely no way is the church going to Petra. And he said that at a sermon at Bricket Wood in England. And his dad happened to be there at the time and was most upset, because he thought there's still a pretty good chance it's Petra. And here's my son telling the entire church it's definitely not Petra. So I think Ted Armstrong said in the morning, it's not Petra. And Mr. Herbert Armstrong in the afternoon said, it probably is Petra. So it was a bit of a public dispute there. Looking at Daniel chapter 11 and picking up the story in verse 40, we're talking here about, well, it tells you time of the end, at the time of the end, and we're not quite there yet. The king of the south, whoever that might be, shall attack him, that's king of the north, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and nowadays that would be, you know, tanks and cruise missiles and bombers and things of that nature, with many ships, probably many of them in the air. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, conquer them and pass through. So we know at the towards the very end, the last perhaps 3 years-ish from the very, very, very end, that the king of the south pushes that and makes some sort of aggressive action towards the king of the north. The king of the north retaliates big time and swoops down from the north to the south, and with his huge armies and air force and so on, obviously decimates the land. But verse 41, he, the king of the north, shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries, many, shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand: Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, these many countries, and even the land of Egypt shall not escape. So this powerful king of the north stomps all over the Middle East, causing mayhem and destruction and conquering and securing oil and who knows what not. But strangely enough, in passing it says that these shall escape: Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. And what's interesting is that Petra was the ancient capital of Edom. So therefore, if you wanted to ensure that the physical city of Petra was left alone by the king of the north, you'd have to ensure that, if you like, that Jordan as a whole was left out of the king of the north's conquering plans. So therefore, the sort of reading the lines is, there you are. God is keeping Petra, if you like, liberated as part of Jordan, because you've got to get the church in there and keep them safe. Now, that's an inference. It's far from definite. And the answer is, if you want to know where the place of safety is going to be, no idea. But the scriptures do hint at Petra, and some people think that's complete, absolute rubbish, and Herbert Armstrong was a maniac for suggesting it, but he wasn't the first. Petra's been suggested as a place for decades before that. In fact, Petra appears in one of the Left Behind books. There's a whole series of books written by Tim LaHaye and Jerry, somebody other, entitled The Left Behind series, all about what happens after the secret rupture takes place. The secret rapture takes place. Then those who are left behind, of course, are attacked by the Antichrist. But actually, in one of those books, Petra is the place where the Jews run to escape. So, you know, Petra is known by quite a number of people. So maybe it's the place, maybe it's not. I would hate to sort of say definitely no. Equally, I'm not going to say definitely yay. Mr. Bob Ardis, formerly of the Worldwide Church of God and formerly of the Philadelphia Church of God, says Petra is absolutely, categorically, definitely no way, not ever, never going to be the place of safety. It's a place of total annihilation, and go there at your absolute peril. And his view is the most probable place of safety is going to be in Saudi Arabia, near what he believes the correct Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, is. Because that's a tricky place to get to in today's world as well. So I think, brethren, let's make sure we're ready to go to the place of safety, qualified to go to the place of safety, not get too uptight as to exactly, you know, where it might be. And as to the question of whether it'll be the minority or the majority, I really don't know. All that sort of struck me was, if you look at two or three scriptures, to me, purely my personal opinion, if I was Fred Coulter, I'd ring a little cowbell or something, because the scriptures are far from plain. It just seemed to me that most likely the majority are not in the place of safety. Reasons for that are just my feelings in a sense, but if you think about what the final era of the church is, what is it? It's called Laodicea, is it not? What do you know about Laodicea? Well, let's turn to Revelation chapter 3, quick reminder. And we believe that we're in Laodicea now. I think in olden days we thought Philadelphia would fly off and leave these creeps called Laodicea behind, but now we discover that actually we're in among them and possibly comprise them. And we look at Revelation chapter 3 about our era. This is the era that you and I are part of. And of course, we all know that we're in it, but entirely separate from it, because we're holy, righteous, and nigh on perfect. So it doesn't really apply to us. But if it did apply to us, this is what would tell us. Revelation 3:16, because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spit, vomit, or spew you out of my mouth. So the final era doesn't get very good marks according to this. And this is the predominant characteristic of this final era. So I would say, therefore, this describes the majority church member. In the average church member, the majority of the population of the Church of God in the final era are lukewarm, and Jesus wants no part of them. It says in verse 18, I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich. And certainly tribulation could be described as a fire, so it may be that the Laodiceans as a group, and that would be the majority of the church today, may have to buy their gold in a very fiery environment. And verse 19, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten, be zealous and repent. And of course, none of us would have to remain Laodicean, but that is the predominant characteristic of the Church of God at this time. Now, if you think about all the warnings that we've looked at in the past, I think typically we go over them on the Day of Trumpets. Jesus warned again and again and again, watch out, be alert, be ready, don't go to sleep, don't be distracted. Did he not? Again and again and again, take care that no one deceive you. The whole New Testament is filled with warnings and warnings and warnings. And it seems that the closer you get to the end, unfortunately, the sleepier and dozier God's people get, which is, you know, it's sort of counterintuitive in a sense. You think as we all get closer to the end, we'd get sharper, more alert, more zealous. But, you know, human nature, Satan's deception, but Jesus warned again and again and again. And I take the warnings to be because we need them. And probably because Jesus saw that at the end, people would just miss it big time. And if you turn to Daniel chapter 7, there's a couple of scriptures that are, you could take them either way. I'm taking them one particular way. Perhaps I'm just being a pessimist. but then again, when I look around the Church of God today, it doesn't look hugely impressive, I've got to say. So Daniel chapter 7 and verse 25. Book of Daniel, Book of Revelation sort of go together in a sense. Mr. Armstrong made it, I think, pretty plain that you can't understand the Book of Revelation unless you got a good understanding of the Book of Daniel, which is why we did Daniel a few months ago, because many, many places that we'll see in a few minutes, they go sort of side by side. But notice Daniel 7, verse 25. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High. This is the papacy, basically. Shall persecute the saints of the Most High. Shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. So this is the final 3.5 times in which the woman is in the place of safety, wherever that might be. But notice it says here that the saints are given to the Vatican's hand for a time, times and half a time. Well, it just says the saints. Taking that as it reads, the saints are put under the foot, the jackboot of the Catholic dominated Europe, the saints. Now you could say, well, the minority, the ones that don't escape. Well, yeah, it could be that, certainly, but just reading it as it comes, it pretty much just says, well, the saints. And to me that implies that, well, actually, that's the majority position. The saints as a group, the saints as a whole, the saints by and large are given into the hand of the Vatican, the papacy, and this Catholic-dominated Europe for time, times, and half a time, in which, thankfully, some have escaped. But to me that reads like, to me that implies it's the saints as a whole in general who are under the boot. Now if you turn to Daniel chapter 12 and verse 7, then I heard that the man clothed in linen, this was an angel, who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it shall be for a time, times and half a time, same time, and when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. So again, just reading that, it pretty much, well, it doesn't imply, it actually says it. It says that the power of the holy people is completely shattered. So again, to me, that would imply that the majority position is in the wrong place. The saints as a whole, under the boot of the papacy, and the power of the saints, totally, completely, utterly shattered. But perhaps only a small number in the place of safety. Now, I might be totally wrong about that. I'm just passing on as an aside anyway. I didn't explain that last week. Somebody asked me afterwards, why do I think that way? Well, that's why I think that way, but I could be thinking wrong. Okay, so I think we can now conclude with that chapter 12. We've now totally guaranteed where the place of safety is. And tickets are available from Mr. Gerald Flurry, Mr. David C. Pack, Mr. Robert Ardis, and sundry others. Chapter 13, Book of Revelation. Looks a bit complicated, I've got to say, this chapter. Don't get any easier as we go along. Chapter 13, verse 1. You may as well keep another $50 bill in the Book of Daniel, because we'll be back there a few times. Like I said, Daniel and Revelation really are two very similar books, full of detail about the end of the age and the empires and so on. And certainly you would have to know Daniel to understand Revelation, and Revelation in turn helps you to understand Daniel. So Revelation 13 verse 1, "Then I stood on the sand of the sea and saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon," that would be Satan, that's easy enough that part, "gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. I saw one of his heads," and he had seven, don't forget, "as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast." Well, that's clear enough, isn't it? Well, we'll spend a wee bit of time in trying to dig into that. There are two beasts in Revelation chapter 13. This beast, and if you look at just verse 11 for a moment, "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon." So there's two beasts in this particular chapter. The first beast comes out of the sea, the second beast comes out of the earth. We'll get to the second beast at some point, but we're going to concentrate now on the first beast. And verse 1 tells us this beast had seven heads, ten horns. The ten horns turn out to be on the seventh head. And verse 2 tells us some of the characteristics of this particular beast. The beast has bits of a leopard, bits of a bear, and bits of a lion. But he's actually, if you like, empowered, influenced, and motivated by Satan. This is a beast, which a beast is a wild animal. I think the King James Version in Revelation 4 and 5 talks about the beasts around God's throne, like the cherubim, but that word beast is different. That word beast is just a creature, a creation of God. This here is a beast. This is a wild beast, a dangerous beast. And I think we'll know before we get too far that this beast is an empire, right? This we'll find out as we go, hopefully, that this is the civil Roman Empire. But we'll get there in a moment or two. So here's a beast with seven heads, ten horns, and we see the bits of a leopard, a bear, and a lion. And of course, immediately you shout, "Aha! That reminds me of Daniel, doesn't it?" And of course, it does remind us of Daniel. If we flip back to Daniel chapter 2. Now, Daniel, you'll recollect, does give us prophecies of the entire future of the Gentile kingdoms of the earth. So in Daniel chapter 2, you may recollect Nebuchadnezzar, who was the big head honcho in Babylon, had had this strange dream, but he hadn't got a clue what the strange dream meant, and nobody else did either, for that matter. So he's busy having them all executed until thankfully Daniel came to the rescue. And Daniel starts to explain what the dream of this great, huge statue meant. And the statue, you may recollect, had sort of four different metals. It had a head of gold, a chest of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, iron, legs, and the legs went all the way down to the bottom where the feet were, and then the feet were finally destroyed by a stone which was cut out of the mountains without hands and crushed the feet, and the statue fell over, fragmented, and was all blown away. And so Daniel starts to explain verse 31, Daniel 2. You, O king, were watching in your dream, and behold, a great image, or a great statue. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. And then Daniel starts to explain precisely what this meant. Verse 36. This is the dream. Now, we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, Nebuchadnezzar, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. So Nebuchadnezzar, representing the kingdom or empire of Babylon, was the head of gold. Gold being very valuable, top quality. But after you, verse 39, shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours. Clearly that would be silver. And then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided in its latter days, this would be. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. So there's only four kingdoms mentioned here, and they take us right down to Jesus' return. Verse 42. And as the toes of the feet, and there be, of course, ten toes, were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom at that end time shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, intermarriage, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, and we take that to be the ten toes, at the very, very, very end of the Roman Empire, in the days of these, let's say, ten kings or ten kingdoms, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So we won't belabor this because we've done it in the past, but you had the Babylonian Empire, followed by the Medo-Persian Empire of silver, the Greek Empire of bronze, the Roman Empire, which has continued off and on with several resurrections right down to today. Got one more resurrection to happen, and then the final resurrection of the iron legs, when you get to the Tobits, Jesus Christ will return, destroy all the Gentile kingdoms, and set up the kingdom of God. Like verse 44 says, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And that's the kingdom of God. You know, some people talk about the kingdom of God being something in your heart, some fluffy, warm feeling. But the kingdom of God is like the Babylonian kingdom, or the Medo-Persian kingdom, or the Greek kingdom. It's a real kingdom, ruled over by God, and at that time, his resurrected saints. So over to Daniel 7 now. So we've got these, if you like, these four world-ruling empires taking us right up to Christ's return. But remember, in the strange beast of Revelation 13, there was a lion and a bear and a leopard. Now let's look at Daniel chapter 7, because here we'll find, interestingly, the same beasts appearing. So Daniel chapter 7 and verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And you may recollect, and you will if you look back, that in Revelation 13, the beast comes out of the sea. This strange beast that John saw comes out of the sea. And here, Daniel, some, what, 500-600 years earlier, sees the winds stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion. Of course, we know this is Daniel looking ahead in time. One of the big differences from John in the book of Revelation is that John came, if you like, after the event, was looking at things as they were at that time, whereas Daniel is looking from the beginning into the future. When Daniel was looking at his prophecies, Medo-Persia was just coming on the scene, Greece was hundreds of years in the future, and Rome was way off in the distance. So what Daniel saw was four consecutive animal empires here. The first was like a lion, verse 5, the second like a bear, verse 6, the third like a leopard. And remember, the beast in Revelation is like a lion, like a bear, like a leopard. So there's a real connection there. Notice also in verse 6, I looked and there was another like a leopard, which was Greece, which had on his back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. And then, verse 7, is when we get to the Roman Empire. I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful, terrible, exceedingly strong. No animal is like this beast. John can't find anything to describe this one as. It's like, well, it's so different. This beast is just awful, dreadful, terrible, exceedingly strong, and it's huge iron teeth. And it devours and breaks in pieces and tramples. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So there are four beasts here, a lion, a bear, a leopard with four heads, and a fourth beast with 10 horns. So if you add that lot up, those of you who are mathematicians, there's a lion with one head, a bear with one head, a fourth beast with one head, and a third beast with four heads makes 7 heads. And 10 horns on the last beast. And the lion, the bear, and the leopard are included. And so we move back now to Revelation chapter 13. What we've actually got is John, somewhere around about 90 to 100 AD, living the days of the Roman Empire, and actually envisioned at some yet future stage. And what John sees, if you like, is a composite of all the previous world-ruling empires. Babylon, the lion, has long since gone, but if you like, its strengths, characteristics, had been absorbed by Medo-Persia, the bear, which is also now long since gone. But its characteristics, many of them, assumed by the Greek Empire with its four heads, but that's also long since gone. But its influence is still even felt today, Hellenistic art and sculpture and so on, and literature. And so what John sees is actually the Roman Empire, but it now comprises the heads, the horns, the creatures of the past. So what we're looking at here in chapter 13, verses 1 and 2, is a description of the civil Roman Empire, comprising, if you like, all the previous world-ruling empires, which have now been, if you like, swallowed up by it. Then we get to verse 3, and I saw one of his heads as it had been mortally wounded. Well, of course, the only head that was actually alive at this time was the head of the Roman Empire, because the Medo-Persian and the Babylonian and the Greek heads were all long since gone. The living head was the Roman Empire head, and it says here, mortally wounded. I think the King James Version says a deadly wound, and it says here his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So in a sense, the beast itself doesn't die. The Gentile kingdoms are going to continue right down to Christ's return, but the Roman Empire, which was the empire of John's day, absorbing all these previous empires and being described as a seven-headed, ten-horned beast, suffers a deadly wound, a mortal wound. And so what would that be? Well, the understanding we've always had seems to fit, when you time with other things, is that this was when the Roman Empire did actually come to an end. The civil Roman Empire came to its end in 476 AD. It actually ceased to exist. At that stage, the Roman Empire was in two bits. There was the western part, where Rome is, and there was the eastern part over at Constantinople. But the western part, the main part, ceased to exist because it was invaded and destroyed. And they say that is the 476 AD is when the Dark Ages began. 476 AD is when the Wikipedia and other well-known history sources like that will tell you the Middle Ages began in 476 AD with the fall of Rome. Another page I looked at in Wikipedia said that the Dark Ages are counted from 476 AD when the Western Roman Empire ceased to exist. So 476 AD is the date when the Roman Empire of John's day finally ceased to exist, when it was invaded by, strangely enough, the Germans. Get around a wee bit. And so for the next 100 years or something, nearly 100 years, not quite as long as that, next to 80 or 90 years, Rome was pillaged, raped and burned a number of times. In fact, it was captured, it was looted, you know, all the sort of wealthy bits and pieces, statues, gold, silver, carted off by three groups who came one after the other, the Vandals. We all talk about vandalism and people destroy things. Well, the name came from the Vandals and what they did to Rome. So the Vandals messed up Rome rather badly. Then you had another bunch called the Heruli, H-E-R-U-L-I, and the third bunch called the Ostrogoths, O-S-T-R-O, then Goths, the Ostrogoths. And these three kingdoms sort of ruled over Italy and sort of ruled from Rome. They were a transitional period before the Roman Empire was healed. And the Catholics didn't like the Vandals, the Heruli, or the Ostrogoths because they had the wrong version of Catholicism. They had a different version of Christianity, so the Pope, who lived in Rome at the time, looked down on these three groups, and he was very keen to get, let's say, a mainstream Catholicism back in Rome and Italy, and encouraged the emperor in the east, Mr. Justinian, to sort of send troops, armies, generals across, which he did do, to liberate Rome from the Vandals, Heruli, and Ostrogoths, which was achieved. They booted them out. And in 554 AD, so what's that, about 80 years later, 554 AD, Justinian came back and took power over Rome, and that's referred to in the Wikipedia history books as the Imperial Restoration. It restored the empire to Rome. So this is perceived, you know, by many biblical scholars, Mr. Armstrong, Ambassador College, Correspondence Course, all of our books, to be the date when the deadly wound was healed. 554 AD, known in history as the Imperial Restoration, when Justinian actually authorized the popes and bishops to govern, because he was still going to live over in the eastern part, in Istanbul, Constantinople. And so for the Western Empire, he actually said that the popes and bishops, they'd got the infrastructure, they'd got the government system, they'd got the people, they'd got the priests, they should actually govern. So rather amazingly, from 554 onwards, the Catholic Church started to govern over the Western part of the Roman Empire, which is why the healed Roman Empire is often called the Holy Roman Empire. It's Rome. It's the Roman Empire. It's been healed and restored, but now for the first time properly, the Roman Catholic Church starts to guide, to influence, to take control, all thanks to Mr. Justinian. So that's the sort of the our beliefs about the deadly wound and its healing. Verse 4, so they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? In a sense, of course, you may not worship Satan directly, but if you're worshipping, if you like, approving and admiring and adoring Satan's creation, Satan's government, Satan's military, Satan's empire, in a sense, you're giving a great deal of credit and praise, perhaps unknowingly, to the dragon. Notice how they admire, how they adore, how they worship. Who could fight this empire? Who's like the beast? Who could make war with this empire, this beast? And so on. Verse 5. And he was given a mouth. This would be, come to mind, spar notes, the Vatican. So the civil Roman Empire has been, if you like, killed off. It's been healed. And now, for the first time, the papacy, the Catholic religion, has now managed to plug right into to government and is, if you like, a spokesperson. So that's the dictate. This mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and was given authority to continue for 42 months. Now, what would that be? Well, there's two possible explanations of this period of 42 months. The one that you find in Who is the Beast? And the mark of the beast, and correspondence course and so on, is that, well, the 42 months is a prophetic period. It's talking from when the healing took place in 554 AD. 42 months, if you apply 30 days per prophetic month, you get 1260, which equates to years in prophecy, and brings you up from 554 AD up to 1814 AD. So therefore, if you're looking at, if you like, the long-term fulfillment of this part of Revelation 13, you're saying, okay, we're looking at this mouth being given great authority, and the beast being given great power for a period of 1260 years, from 554, when it was healed, until 1814. Okay. If that's the case, what happened in 1814? Well, 1814 was the collapse of Napoleon's empire, and Napoleon was, we believe, the eighth of the Ten Horns. Cover that another time perhaps, but you've got all these resurrections of the Roman Empire, Justinian and Charlemagne and Otto the Great and Charles the Fifth, and then Napoleon. Napoleon abdicated, having been booted out, in 1814. And then an interesting comment made in a history book that's quoted in many of the church sources, which says, regarding 1814 and Napoleon's abdication, so closed a government that dated from Augustus Caesar. So that particular historian, Mr. Willis Mason West, took the view that Napoleon's stepping down from power actually closed a government that went all the way back to ancient Rome. That was his understanding of history. I don't know that much about ancient and medieval history, I couldn't comment, but his view was that actually the Roman Empire off and on had ruled from Augustus Caesar's days right down to 1814, and then it stopped. That's one explanation that I think is the more generally accepted one. Another possibility is that somewhere around about verses 4 and 5 we actually jump, if you like, from the long-term view to the end times. These are inset chapters we're looking at. Chapter 12 was an inset chapter, but chapter 12 sort of picks up the story of the church from ancient times right up to today. Chapter 13 describes the beast, one of the main players, but equally describes the beast from its ancient times right up to our time. So somewhere around about verse 5-ish, it could be that the story's actually jumped into the end times, and it's talking here about, it says, given a mouth speaking great things blasphemies, given authority to continue for 42 months. It's quite possible, I think it's actually quite probable, it actually means 42 months at the end time. You've seen already time, times and half a times, 1260 days, we'll look at a few in a second. This could well be talking about the actual power given to the end time version of the beast. The man, obviously empires, kingdoms, are often represented by their kings, the monarch, the head man. And so here at the end of the age, the beast empire, obviously in a sense, finds its final representation in the man that is in charge of it. The individual who becomes the beast, the head of the beast, the man who guides and governs. And so is given power, it says, for 42 months, verse 6. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, those who dwell in heaven. It was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. So I'm thinking here that the 42 months is literal. It's 3.5 years at the very end. And to this individual, which could be either the beast or his accomplice, the false prophet, is given power to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And like we said earlier, if you just read that as it comes and you didn't know about this place of refuge, you just take that as being, well, the saints are in trouble. And that again supplies or suggests to me that it's the majority that are in trouble and not the minority. So if you hold your place there and just look, think about the 42 months for a moment, right? This individual is given power and authority to make war with the saints and overcome them for 42 months, as well as authority over every tribe on the earth. Look at chapter 11 of Revelation, verse 2. Leave out the court, which is outside the temple. Don't measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. So we know that Jerusalem, the Jews, and both of the saints will be trodden underfoot for 42 months. Now look at Revelation 12:14. We were there earlier. The woman is given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time, times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. That's the same length of time, closely. It may not be to the very day, depending on how you want to interpret a month, but it's a very similar period of time. And of course, whilst that's taking place, verse 17 of Revelation 12 tells us that the dragon was enraged with the woman and went to make war with the saints who keep the commandments. We just saw there in Revelation 13:7 that he makes war with the saints. And that must be the same time that the woman's in the place of safety, time, times and half a time. So it's like, it's all rather sort of similar periods and similar activities. And then Daniel 7, if we go back there for a moment. Hopefully you've got your $50 bill still in Daniel 7. You probably need two or three $50 bills. Make it easy for yourself. Daniel 7, and we'll read again the verses we read earlier. But again, just bear in mind, this 42 months, this 3.5 years, Jerusalem trodden underfoot, one part of the church in a place of refuge, Satan making war on the rest, this mouth having authority to make war on the saints for 3.5 years. And again, let's read Daniel 7, 24 and 25. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, from the Roman Empire. Another horn shall arise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue 3 kings. This was the Vatican, the papacy, getting rid of the first 3 empires, the Ostrogoths, Heruli, Vandals. Right? He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. So it all seems to add up that the saints are in serious trouble for 3.5 years. 42 months, 1260 days. So we can jump back now to Revelation 13. And we go as far as verse 7. It was granted to him to make war. I mean, you don't want to be in this, do you, really? This is a reading about, you know, like an academic sort of scenario, and fighting our way through heads and horns and toes and elbows and all the rest of it. But realistically, all of these things we're reading about will happen to this earth. Billions, we've said before, will die. And, you know, the saints, some of them, now whether it's the majority or minority, well, that's, time will show us. But either way, if it's a minority that left behind, you don't want to be one of those, do you? If it's a majority left behind, you don't want to be one of those either. So therefore, you know, take heed when it says the saints are going to be persecuted, have war made against them, and an enraged Satan takes after them and makes war. You know, we don't want to be there. Verse 8, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Now hopefully, your name, my name, is written in the book of life. But for the rest, they're going to worship this empire, this great kingdom, this peacemaking empire, and its head man, this individual that personifies the empire, this man of peace. He's going to eradicate all these heretics who are disturbing the peace of the nation. I mean, he's not going to look like an ogre to the world. He might to you and I, and if you're at the receiving end of an enraged Satan and a war-making, persecuting beast, then you'll know the truth. But for the world as a whole, they're going to think this guy is great. Nobel Peace Prize winner. Looks good. Says the right things. A man of peace, bringing finally after centuries of war and fighting and so on and starvation and all the rest of it, bringing peace to the world. He's going to look like a great peacemaker. He's going to look good. Just like Satan appears as an angel of light, which he most certainly isn't, but that's the way he'll appear. And this man's going to deceive the whole world. It says, verse 8, all who dwell on the earth will worship him. That's probably talking of the man that finally ends up as, if you like, the beast in person. Verse 9, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. I take that to mean that if you're one of the saints who is in the midst of all of this, in which case we all pity you and ourselves if we're among them, it's perhaps a reminder. You just have to be patient, because ultimately, you know, God will mete out vengeance. You know, those that capture will go into captivity, and those who kill with the sword and the cruise missile and the grenade will themselves be killed by it. Nothing you and I could do in that scenario. We can't take it on. It just means, I guess, you know, await patiently God's vengeance. Have that trust that at the right time God will intervene and put an end to this carnage on the earth, put an end to this beast and his government. Okay, let's make at least a start now on the second beast. Verse 11, then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. Now, horns symbolize usually a kingdom or a government. So here's, if you like, a kingdom which is in two parts. Two horns. Two parts. And we'll identify in advance, although you've read this, I'm sure, many times over. It's already, this is the papacy we're talking about here, and the Vatican. It's the Roman Catholic Church. And the Vatican today is in two parts. The Catholic Church has a state, Vatican State. Vatican State is actually the smallest state in the world. Population of the state of the Vatican is only 900. And the Pope happens to be an elected monarch of the Vatican State. So the Catholic Church already is a civil state, as well as, of course, being a religious, ecclesiastical empire with a citizenship of over a billion. So the Catholic Church certainly has got two horns, state and church combined, and of course speaks like a dragon. Oh yeah, it does too. It may appear like a lamb, peaceful. Jesus is the Lamb of God, of course, and here is an empire, a kingdom, a Catholic empire, which appears like a lamb, goody goody, two shoes, you know, bless you my son, all that carry on, but actually the voice, if you recognize it, is the voice of Satan. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. The reason for that reference to deadly wound was healed is because the Catholic Church didn't dominate until after Justinian healed the Roman Empire in 554 AD. In the early stages, the Ostrogoths and Vandals and Heruli, the Catholic Church had hardly any influence. And the old civil empire, of course, they just worshipped directly the sun and the emperor. But once the deadly wound was healed, once Justinian gave the popes authority and accepted, in a sense, almost their rule over him, suddenly you had the Holy Roman Empire. And of course, you know, over the years, the Catholic Church has virtually, you know, commanded its followers to show allegiance and loyalty, you know, to the empire and equally to itself. Verse 13, he performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And somewhere along here, it jumps from the background history of this church empire to the end time application. It suggests here that at the very end time, the final false prophet, and that's how he's called in other chapters, the false prophet, is able to do some marvelous signs. It says he performs great signs, this false prophet, this head of the second beast, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And let's just have a quick look at Matthew 24. You'll see that you've been warned about this, as I have. Matthew 24. Jesus talking, giving his Olivet prophecy, Matthew 24, and we want verses 21 through 25. Matthew 24, starting verse 21. For then, says Jesus, there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And it's, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. We've seen the number of killed in other parts of Revelation, you're up to the billions. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Then, at that troublesome time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders, so as to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So Jesus says, watch out, there will be false anointed ones, and there'll be false prophets who will show great signs and wonders. And we're told here in Revelation 13, verse 13, that this individual, this false prophet, can even make fire come down from heaven in the sight of men. Verse 14, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Martyrdom coming if you don't worship the image of the beast. And verse 16, He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name, which of course is the famous mark of the beast. Do you want it or do you not? Well, I guess looking at the watch, we've run totally out of time, as is the norm, so I guess we'll have to stop there, because that's quite a juicy bit to cover next week. So I think we're there. We'll conclude our Bible study for this week, and if we get more in,